How's everybody doing? So this is our second week in our sermon series called Exiled, where we're looking at stories from the Bible where times where God's people were living in seasons of exile, and we're figuring out what it meant for them to live lives that were still obedient to God and to live as a community that still honored God. And despite the major opposition that they were facing during those times of exile from the culture around them and from the kings and the rulers that governed over them. And we're seeing how this applies to us. And the question that we're trying to answer in this series is, what does it look like? What does it look like for us as Christians in the 21st century to live as citizens, not of this city, of this nation, or of this world, but as citizens first of the kingdom of God? And I love how Wendy introduced us to this series last week as she explained to us the connection between the Israelites' time of exile in Babylon and how that relates to our exile as Christians in this world. And she taught us and talked about our home, where our home is. And the definition that she gave is that our home is where Jesus reigns and where God's will is done. So Christians all throughout the world, no matter what country they're living in, are all living in exile. And for us Christians that are living here right now, we know that this is not our home. Our home is God's kingdom in heaven. It's where Jesus reigns and where his will is done. She also explained to us that as we look at these stories of the Bible from the perspective of the Israelites, it's hard for us to really grasp and see it through their eyes because they were a conquered people group. They were living in exile and they were conquered from the Babylonians. And it's hard for us, especially Americans from the majority culture, to see it that way because all too often throughout history, we unfortunately have been the conquerors. And in many ways, we continue to be. And I'm going to get a little bit more into that and the theology behind that later in the message. But I just want to point out that in order for us to avoid misinterpreting this story, and in order for us to avoid misinterpreting the stories throughout this message, we have to hold on to the truth and the fact that this is not our home. We have to remember that. The theme passage for this series is in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 11 to 12. And I think it's up on the screen, from the Message translation of the Bible, it says this. It says, "Friends, this world is not your home, so don't make yourselves cozy in it. Don't indulge your ego at the expense of your soul. Live an exemplary life among the natives so that your actions will refute their prejudices. Then they'll be won over to God's side and be there to join in the celebration when he arrives." I'm going to pray real quick for us. Lord, I thank you for who you are. I thank you for bringing us all here this morning and allowing us to have an opportunity to come together and to fellowship and to worship together in your name, Lord, to worship you. God, I just pray that you would speak through me this morning, Lord, that these words would not be my own, but they would be yours. And God, I just ask that you would open up my heart and open up all of our hearts to hear what you want to communicate to us today. Lord, may your spirit come and reign in this room right now. We love you, Lord. Does anybody remember the social pressure in high school to fit in? Anybody remember that? Was there anybody that didn't feel that pressure in high school? If you didn't, you're probably a cool kid. If you didn't go to high school in the U.S., I can't be sure how your experience was, but I know that here there's a lot of pressure to fit in, and students tend to kind of self-segregate into different social groups. I went to high school in the Midwest, and though I went to a pretty ethnically diverse high school, it was still kind of like the stereotypical American high school experience. There were different groups that kids assimilated into. You know, there was like the cool kids who were, you know, mostly like the athletes and the cheerleaders. Then there was, there were like the really smart kids, people called the nerds, and looked down on them, but now they're like the most successful of any of us. But there was, you know, the band geeks or whatever, choir kids, drama kids. Then there was like, you know, the class clowns. And then there was even like a few groups of kids that didn't really fit into any of those groups. They were kind of on the margins, like the goths. I don't know if you had those in your school, like kids that wore all black and like JNCOs. Anybody remember JNCOs? They were like these jeans with, I don't even know how to describe them, but they were weird. Not the kids, the jeans. Yeah, kids, goths, skaters, you know, stoners. And kids also kind of self-segregated according to their race or ethnicity. But I remember that everyone was always trying to fit in. You know, people wanted to be a part of a group. And the people from your group, those were the people that you ate lunch with every day in the cafeteria. You ate lunch with the group of people that you were accepted into. And like one of the scariest things in high school was not being accepted into any of those groups and having to eat alone. Anybody's high school experience was like that? You remember that? So that social pressure to fit in, that would cause students, you know, to join certain extracurricular activities sometimes or to play sports or even sometimes to behave in a way that may not line up with their character because they wanted to fit in. Because the most feared thing, at least when I was in high school, was not fitting in. You know, I was fortunate to, you know, go to a high school that was like really, really large. And there was a few dozen kids from my church that were also in my high school. So I had good influences around me. I had a positive group of friends, you know, to hang out with at school, to eat lunch with, to figure out how to navigate life at that age. And I'm very thankful for that because I think that played a role in protecting me from going down certain paths. But from the time we are young, there is this pressure on us to conform. To conform so that we fit into a certain group. To conform by living or acting a certain way so that we are accepted. And even in my church youth group, there was an expectation of conformity. There was a way you had to live. There was certain things you had to do to be accepted. When I was 16 years old, I went on a mission trip to Brazil. I went through this youth organization for 3 weeks. It was a three-week trip, and there was a group of about 12 of us, American teenagers, and a few adult leaders from all over the country that went down there together that had never met before. I mean, a few of them knew each other, but I didn't know anyone going into this trip. It was a great trip. We put on this vacation Bible school, worked with the kids in this church and the community, and spent a lot of time fellowshipping with this church. It was an amazing church where, you know, we encouraged them and they encouraged us. But prior to this trip, I didn't know anybody. And I remember this very surreal moment that I had going into the trip. I boarded a plane in my hometown, St. Louis, to fly down to Miami to meet this group of kids from all over the country. And I remember thinking to myself, who am I? See, I grew up with the same group of kids my entire life, from kindergarten to 12th grade, and I have a huge extended family. You know, everybody, you know, lives nearby, and I realized that I had never in my life been around people who didn't know me or who didn't have any expectation of how I would act or how I would behave. I was never the new kid. And I remember I just started thinking to myself, how will I act? Will I be the same as I usually am? Will I be a completely different person? And at first, I was a little bit nervous about that. But as I got closer to Miami, that those nerves and that fear kind of started to change to excitement. Because I realized I was getting a completely blank slate. And I was excited to find out if I was different or who I really was. So when I got to Miami, I tried to just be myself, to not worry or think about what any of those other kids thought of me, and I was thankful to find out that I really wasn't maybe as different as I feared on the plane. I did learn a few things about myself, though. You know, in school, even though I did have a positive group of friends around me, I still kind of like to be the center of attention. I don't know if you can believe that or not. So I was a little bit of a troublemaker. I wasn't like too bad, you know, but I wasn't the teacher's favorite kid, really. You know, I was a little disruptive because I liked making kids laugh. What I wanted was to be accepted and to be affirmed by my peers in school. So even in high school for me, there were some ways that I had conformed to the social pressure that was around me. We face a lot of that pressure in high school. But that pressure to conform, it doesn't stop after high school. It actually follows us into adulthood. And we begin making all these decisions about our lives, if we're going to go to college, what we're going to study, where we're going to live, what kind of job we want, if we're going to get married, if we're going to have kids. And my question is, what are the values that are driving us as we make all those decisions? As adults, It might be less about social pressure or a desire to fit in that we're conforming to, but become more about maybe not disappointing our parents, or maybe a desire to be successful. But then, what does it mean to be successful? How do we define success? If our definition of success is the American dream, what has led us to that conclusion? If our definition of success is to make a difference in people's lives, even though that's a good thing, where's that coming from? Is it coming from a desire to live in obedience to God? Or is it coming from a desire to feel good about ourselves? And are we conforming to the will of God? Or are we conforming to the value system of the world around us? If our definition of success is coming from ourselves, from selfish desires within us, from our own pride, if it's coming from the influence of our family, or if it's coming from the values of the culture around us that tells us what's important, rather than from God, then we're conforming to the world. I love the definition that Pete Scazzaro, the author of Emotionally Healthy Spirituality, gives us for success. He says that success is to become the people God wants us to be and to do what God wants us to do. I wonder how many of us here this morning are like me sitting on that plane on my way to Miami. We have no idea who we really are. And it's not just coming from a social pressure to fit in, but it's from all these worldly cultural influences all around us. From what society is telling us, from what our families have driven into our minds and our hearts about what it means to be successful, and we have no idea who we really are. How many of us are living our lives based not on who God created us to be, but based on what other people or what culture has created us to be? In this world where there's so much pressure around us, competing for our attention, trying to influence us, how are we as Christians supposed to respond to all this? How are we supposed to live differently as God's people in exile, as though this world is not our home? There's a great story in Daniel chapter 3 that talks exactly about this. It's about three men who were under immense amount of pressure to conform to the culture around them. But they resisted that pressure, and they stood firm in their convictions. And they resisted not just a pressure to fit in or a desire to be successful, but they resisted a king's decree. See, during the time that the Israelites were living in exile in Babylon, there was a king named King Nebuchadnezzar who ruled over all the land. And King Nebuchadnezzar, he constructed this giant golden statue that was 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide. And after he constructed this statue, he summoned all the judges, the governors, the treasurers, all the officials, all the leaders that worked in all the provinces throughout Babylon to the province of Dura, where he set up this golden statue. So there were many people gathered there from all these different regions and nations, and even people that spoke many different languages. And this herald, he spoke and called out to them all, and he said to them, "All of you that are gathered here today, whenever you hear the sound of our horns, our flutes, our drums, when you hear our band begin to play music, you must bow down to worship this image of gold that the king has set up. And anyone that does not bow down and worship this statue will be thrown into a blazing furnace." And after that, the people, they heard the music begin to play, and they all fell down and they worshiped the king's golden statue. There were some men in the crowd, these astrologers actually, that they came forward to the king, to King Nebuchadnezzar, to tell him about these three young Jewish men who worked for him in one of his provinces, who were defying his decree. They told the king that these three men did not fall down and worship his golden statue when the music began to play. And this upset the king, so he summoned these three young men named Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And when they were before him, he asked them if it was true that they did not bow down to worship his statue. He offered them a deal, and he said to them that if they would just fall down and worship this image right now, then he wouldn't punish them for what they did, and he would not throw them into the furnace. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego responded to him, and they said, "We have no need to defend ourselves to you. And if we're thrown into the fire, our God has the power to save us. And even if he doesn't save us, we still will not worship your gods nor your golden statue. The king was furious with their response, and he immediately ordered that they be thrown into the furnace. He had the furnace heated up 7 times hotter than it normally is, and he had his strongest soldiers detain these 3 young men and tie them up and take them to throw them into the furnace. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were thrown into the fire wearing all their clothes, and the story tells us that the fire was turned up so high that it killed the soldiers that took them to the furnace to throw it in just from getting close to it. But shortly after this happened, the king jumped up in amazement, and he asked his advisors if it was indeed 3 men that they threw into the furnace, and his advisor said, of course it was. But the king said, look, I see 4 men walking around in the fire, and they're not tied up. And the fourth looks like a son of the gods. King Nebuchadnezzar called Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego out of the fire, and all the king's officials crowded around them. They saw that their bodies had not been harmed, not even one of the hairs on their heads had been singed, and their clothes weren't burnt. They didn't even smell like fire. When King Nebuchadnezzar saw this, he said, praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. After that, the king made a new decree that anyone who spoke against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would be killed and would have their homes destroyed. And he promoted them in the province that they worked in. So this idol in Babylon that King Nebuchadnezzar constructed, it was 90 feet tall. It was a 90 feet tall golden statue. You could not miss it. And there was a decree, all his leaders had to bow down and worship this idol. I believe that there are many idols in our world today that Satan has constructed all around us. And these are the idols that are attempting to influence us, to control us, and to replace our identity as God's people, with one of the Babylonians. The main difference, though, is that our idols are a lot harder to recognize. What are the idols in our country that seek to destroy and replace our identity in Christ? What are the idols in American culture that are constantly pressuring us to conform? We cannot live as God's people if we aren't aware of the idols around us that are fighting for our worship. We have to be able to recognize them and name them before we can ever resist them. So as I was praying through this and reflecting on this story, the first idol that came to my mind was an idol of greed. We live in a world where there is an unquenchable thirst for more. People just want more and more and more so they can live more extravagantly, so they can show off their status. A world where nothing is sacred, where everything and anything is monetized, where even people are seen as a commodity. We are living in a place, in a land where there's an idol of greed. And that affects us. The next that came to my mind was an idol of self-indulgence, self-centeredness, selfishness. This is an idol that tells us that it's every man for himself, and that if anyone has any needs, if anyone is struggling with anything, that's their problem. There's very little concern for the other, for your neighbor, very little concept of community, of collective responsibility for one another. Everyone's problem is on them. And the church or society has no obligation to step in and to try and help meet the needs or ease the pain of anyone else. We're living in a land that has an idol of selfishness, and that affects us. Another idol I believe we struggle with today is one of national pride. Yes, the scripture says that we are called to submit to our government and to our rulers, but not before our God. And when our nation, you know, when we steer off course in regards to justice or truth, it's our job as Christians to be the prophetic voice, to be the conscience of our nation. Because we as Christians, we know that we are no better as Americans and any people from any other country in the world, because all people are created in the image of God. There's an idol of prideful nationalism that is fighting for our allegiance, and that affects us. We need to define and be aware of our national idols. We must be able to name them so that we can deconstruct them. So these were just a few that came to my mind, but I would like all of us just to take a moment and think about the forces at work. What are the things that are controlling us? What are the things that are guiding the way that we live as individuals, as a community, as a country? Take a minute and just think, what are those things? Greed, selfishness, pride. What else? What are the idols that our community is struggling with? What are the idols that we as individuals are struggling with? What are the idols that our country is struggling with? These things are the idols that everyone around us are bowing down to. It's these idols that are shaping the value systems of Americans and of the people that live here. They're defining our worldviews. They're defining how we define success. But once we're able to name them, then we can begin doing the work of deconstructing them and deconstructing the way that they have influenced us so that we can learn how to live differently, so that we can live as those that are exiled into a foreign land. We must not bow down to these idols. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego knew who they were. They did not forget their identity as God's people. They did not forget their God. And when King Nebuchadnezzar told them to bow down, they simply said no. They said, we need to imitate their example, and we need to stand up to the pressure of society, of the culture around us, and say no. We will not conform to your way of life. We will not bow down to your idols. We have a God who is much more powerful than you are, who will deliver us from your wrath. But even if he doesn't, we still will not worship your golden statue. In order to conform to the will of God, we must resist the sinful cultural influences of our world. In order to conform to the will of God, we must resist the sinful cultural influences of our world. Now, I don't want you to misunderstand me here, because for much of American history, this line of thinking has led the Christian church, especially, into a type of isolation. It's led Christians into a bubble where they resisted the culture of the world by creating their own Christian world. That is not what I'm advocating for, because God tells us that we need to be in the world, but not of the world. We're not supposed to be building up our kingdom, but we're supposed to be building up God's kingdom. God's kingdom that is defined by our radical love for him and our radical love for our neighbor. A kingdom that is committed to both truth and justice. Christians have gotten this wrong for far too long for this reason. They have seen themselves as God's chosen people, and they've seen the United States of America as their promised land. There is, however, one major difference between us and the Israelites. The Israelites had a land covenant with God, and we do not. This very belief, this misinterpretation of theology, is what has led to so much death and destruction all throughout our nation's history. If we believe that we are God's chosen people, and this is our promised land, then anyone who is not a Christian needs to be terminated. They are enemies occupying our promised land. And then you combine the belief that this is our promised land with a white supremacy that doesn't view people of any other race as humans, and what do you end up with? A Native American genocide. The enslavement of African people in a whole host of other terrible things. Whole host of other destruction that has been caused all in the name of God. Still today, many American Christians believe that they are God's chosen people. They may not say that, but subconsciously, that's driving their religion, and that's driving their belief system. They believe that they were destined to rule over this land, and that it was God's intention for this to be a Christian nation. They associate the secularization of our culture and the diversification of our people with the Babylonian exile of the Israelites. They believe that a cultural war is being waged against them, enforcing them into a type of exile. The problem is that their definition of God's kingdom is not the place where Jesus reigns and where his will is done, but it's a Christian American empire. So if we don't have a land covenant with God, and if we haven't acted and treated the Native Americans, African Americans, immigrants, women, children, people of all sexual orientation in love, in a way that is in obedience to God and to God's will, then we are not actually a Christian nation, nor have we ever been. We should not be calling for America to become great again, but we should be admitting and we should be confessing that America was never great. This is not our home. What we have now is entire churches of people who have conformed to the patterns of this world rather than to the will of God. And they've been building up a Christian American empire rather than God's kingdom. And they're not living as exiles in a foreign land, but they're living as reflections of worldly values with a Christian label attached to it. This is not our home. In order to conform to the will of God, we must resist the sinful cultural influences of our world. We resist bowing down to an idol of greed by living generous lives, by giving our money away, by giving our time away. We resist greed by living within our means, by practicing moderation, by not coveting after new things, but by being content with what we have. By expressing gratitude to God for how he has provided for us. We resist this idol of greed by viewing the world and its resources as God's creation, as though everything belongs to him, and we view ourselves not as owners, but as stewards of what he has entrusted to us, both in our finances, but also in our treatment of his earth. We resist this idol of self-indulgence by practicing sexual purity. By acknowledging that we live in a world that tells us that it's all about the moment, it's all about the now, it's about our pleasure right here, but saying we know a better way. We resist selfishness by serving our neighbors, by serving the people around us and doing what we can to love them and to help meet their physical need, by taking up the cause of justice and by mourning with those who mourn. We resist the idol of national pride by learning, by studying the true history of our country, and by listening. We must listen to the voices of the marginalized and the oppressed. We resist this nationalism by telling their stories and by telling the truth. When we do these things, when we resist these sinful influences and the patterns of this world, when we say no to King Nebuchadnezzar and tell him it doesn't matter whether our God delivers our earthly bodies or not, we will not bow down to you. When we live as a people in exile, set apart from the Babylonian culture, then the world will know who God is. They will see him through the fruit and the witness of his people. And 1 Peter tells us, then they will be won over and join in the celebration. We are all broken here today. We are all sinful. our conformity to the patterns of this world, our participation in both corporate sin and also individual sin has separated us from God. And we're all guilty. There's no one here among us that is pure and blameless. There's no one here among us that is good. But we have hope. Because God loved us so much that he saw us in the midst of our mess. And he came down to this earth in the form of a man, in Jesus Christ. And he lived among us. He walked the earth and he faced the same temptations that we face. He felt the same pain that we feel. He loved us so much that he gave up his life for us. He went and he died on a cross in our place. He took the punishment that we deserved so that we would be forgiven and could be reconciled back to him. We're living in a dark time. We're living in a scary time. I can't wait for the election to be over. Everyone seems to be at odds with one another, and there's so much injustice around the world. But we have to remember that this is not our home. That Jesus not only died, but he resurrected from the dead and he overcame all of this darkness. We are exiles living in this sinful world. Exiles who are loved by God. Exiles who have a God that loves us so much that he would go to the cross and die for us. That is where our identity is found. And that is what we need to hold on to. Because that and that alone is what will give us the power and the strength to resist the sinful patterns of the world that are all around us. So that we can build God's kingdom up here on earth, where his will is done as it is in heaven.